I think that the tribes of Montana have quite a unique perspective and relationship with the landscape compared to a lot of the other tribes in America. And then there's the broader worldwide understanding of indigenous philosophy, indigenous perspectives towards the land. But I want to start with Montana tribes because I think that they are in many ways unique compared to all the other regions. And so, you know, by 2000 years ago, agriculture was pretty widespread in what we know of as the United States, continental America, predominantly on the East Coast. You know of the Iroquois Confederacy, but going down all throughout the Mississippi region, and in fact, one of the largest cities in the world, actually oftentimes called the largest city in the world during its heyday, was Cahokia, in and around present-day St. Louis. That was a city society that was built entirely on agriculture. Without any domesticated animals at all, really, playing into it. And so these people became quite wealthy, growing corn, beans, and squash along the Mississippi River and the Mississippi River Valley, and established huge structural monuments as a manifestation of the power that they were able to create with all the surplus foods that they grew. And so we're talking about some of the greatest agriculturalists in the world. You know, they did all this without plow horses, without any oxen. They did all this without insurance or sprinklers. they brought up the seeds, the agriculture from South and Mesoamerica, and had just a tremendous amount of success with it. And we could think of the mounds that were established there and the pyramids that were devised. And I guess one of the things I think about when I think of pyramids, and of course we see pyramids throughout the ancient world, is that the pyramids in the physical form also correlate to pyramids in the economic sense of the word. And so you have great wealth, you're able to create great structures. And within those structures, the society also reflects that top-down way of thinking and looking at things. And so the idea that Locke said, that he propagated as much and as good, with the idea that, you know, it was a sin not to work the land, and that Native Americans weren't working the land, that's something that we've kind of misunderstood for a long time from a lot of different perspectives. In fact, these Native peoples worked the land quite significantly and to tremendous success in areas where it was possible and viable and, made the most sense. Again, these are cultures and communities that had no domesticated animals. And going back into the religious and philosophical history of how people relate to the land, and thinking about in the book of Genesis, which, you know, is such a huge place, has played such a huge role in Western culture for so long. The idea that God tells man, you know, you have domain over all the animals and all the land. I think that is uniquely form-fitting to a group of people who have the animals, and those animals help to prepare the land for the seeds. And so you have a whole domesticated view of the world and the land and the landscape. And that was somewhat a reality here in America when we think of the agricultural revolution that kind of came up here about 2,000 years ago. But looking at Montana, that agricultural revolution never really did infiltrate this region. And for a lot of good and, you know, obvious reasons. You know, my tribe was one of the first groups that came here over 500 years ago, and they came from Cahokian Mound culture. They attempted to grow corn in Montana, and they, you know, had mild success at the beginning with the sedentary way of life way far on the eastern edge of Montana on the Yellowstone River there around Glendive. But the further they moved up into the upper portions of the Yellowstone River, and the more it became apparent that there were plenty of wild plants and wild animals to survive upon, and the less success they had with growing corn because of soil, because of climate, potential droughts, early frosts, late frosts. They abandoned that way of life and became full-time hunter-gatherers and traders. And that term hunter-gatherers is like trying to set up a tripod with only two poles. Anytime two poles get set up, they're going to fall pretty quickly. You have to have a third one. And the trade was just as important as hunting and gathering to these people here. And their idea of public and private property was pretty distinct. Their private property was where they set up their winter campsites. Just like each and every one of us, when we think of our private property, we just don't think of all of the land that we own on the paper. We think of our house. You know, when people say they invaded our, if someone comes into your house when you're gone and they rummage through your stuff and take things from your private collection or whatever, that's an invasion of our private space. On the other hand, a lot of us, if we own acreage and hunters come in and we find out they've been poaching animals or whatever, it doesn't, you know, I mean, there's an invasion there, but it's not the same type of personal invasion that a lot of us would consider, you know, directly impacting our internal psyche. And so for the tribes that lived here in Montana, they would spend a large bulk of their year in their winter campsites, because of course you have to have a good spot to spend the winter next to the water. Place where hopefully you can have some wild animals come by every now and again to harvest. Of course, you have wood down there to burn. You'll have shelter from the wind. And then when the seasons change and the rivers flood and, you know, mosquitoes come back and grizzly bears once again become a part of the environmental reality, they would go out into this public landscape, which was the other 99.99% of where they lived. And we're talking about a group of people who had no means of transportation for 13,000 years or more. So what we're doing today, walking around, that was as good as it got for them. They weren't able to hop on a horse and travel long distances. And so when I think of Plains Indian culture and history, I think of that 13,000 year, 14,000 or whatever you want to estimate it as, history. You know, from the time they got horses to the time the reservation era began, very small blip in time compared to that larger scheme of things. And so all of this area was to them public property. Again, except for the places where they were going to spend the winter. And that's if there was going to be any conflict over land, that's when that conflict occurred. And if someone wanted to infiltrate into their wintering campsites, which was, you know, key to their survival. But the trade culture that they had developed and Really, there's never been a trade culture like it anywhere on the planet. These people developed a lingua franca outside of a colonial era, infringement. So they all spoke plain sign language. And there's never been a language like it in the world. The only other languages that have shared the same geographic area and have been spoken by so many different linguistic groups are because of colonial tyranny. You know, we think of the English language, we think of Russian language, we think of colonial powers that go off and impose their will and enforce their languages and traditions upon other groups. But with plain sign language, there was no one group that could take credit for that. That was a language that was shared by over 44 different tribes in a geographic area from Calgary down to the Gulf of Mexico. And that shared language also reflected their understanding of shared landscape. And that's what separates the Northern Plains, the Great Plains, from practically any other region in the world, was this idea that we shared things, that things were public, and that, in fact, they had to be public in order for us to thrive with one another, so that we could travel around during the warm weather seasons, that we could exchange ideas, exchange ceremonies, exchange, of course, crafts and items that we created. We could exchange food products. We could exchange just funny stories and interesting stories, phenomenon, whether they be weather or spiritual. Excuse me. Exchange germs. exchange DNA, right? And anything and everything that each and every one of us gives us our deepest joy. I mean, what is a life without share and exchange? And the idea that you would share and exchange all these things with the animals was also part of their ceremonial understanding of the world. Which brings me to another term that I think is deep and rooted in the human understanding and association with the natural world, and that is a ceremonial way of life, a ceremonial outlook. And, you know, you talk about John Locke, the idea that, God has asked us to, develop the land, otherwise we're wasting it. Is that a ceremonial approach to the world? That's just a question. I'm not trying to answer it, but I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can answer it. How do you prepare for a ceremony? If you're going to participate in the ceremony, what do you do to get ready? Do you do that every day? Or is that just once a week? How do you physically prepare for a ceremony? How do you spiritually prepare? How do you mentally ready yourself for a ceremony? What are you seeking to achieve from that ceremony? What is the end result of that ceremony? Does it ever begin or does it ever end? You know, those are questions that I think you can approach the Northern Plains way of life and say for thousands of years and even for some folks right up to the present day, you know, a ceremonial way of life means just exactly what John Locke said at the very beginning of your talk, Ed, and hits right to the heart of the matter. Your body is your property. The reason why your body is your property is because it's separate from your spirit. It's separate from your mentality or your consciousness. There's your body and then there's you. Those are two separate things. And on that most basic level, I think that holds a lot of truth for Plains Indians, preparing for the ceremony, getting your body ready for that ceremony so that your spirit can, be propelled from that into a greater understanding of how you fit into all this, the birds, the animals, the trees, because you don't own them. They all take care of themselves. They are all their own property as well. And that respect for that is kind of phenomenological understanding of going about our day. I am me, you are you. We all share things, but at the same time, we have some amount of responsibility and cognizant understanding of what we have to do to make ourselves who we are, I guess. So now I'm starting to trail off, but I'll stop for a second.
I had a question. Yes. So is there a large amount of, I guess, divergence or variance in, I guess, these sort of core beliefs about across Indigenous and Native tribes about the environment and the ways that we interact with them? Or is it fairly consistent, despite the fact that tribes are obviously very varied on their own?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, certainly they all have their own unique beliefs. And then the languages, the way they speak about the world and themselves is kind of, I mean, once you delve into the language, you can kind of get a better sense of how they differ. But
I mean, I think I've always had it in my mind that, although I know there's definitely variance across, that there seems to be some sort of a consistent valuing of the environment and a relationship with the environment, even if there's some maybe different ways of how that meets out. And I didn't know if that's accurate or not.
I think it's accurate on a personal level, and it can be accurate in a community level, but not always. And I think we saw that, we see that manifested in today's tribes with mining and with other issues that are confronted, that they have to take kind of stock of where they stand, if you will, on the side of the environment or not. I think that they tend to fall down on that side of, you know, what's more important, you know, the long-term sustainability of the landscape or the short-term economic impacts that the tribe needs to reap, like with such things as mining or, you know, hunting. And I think that it's difficult to trace how those values have shifted over time, because there have been so many different external forces that have pushed them in one way or the other. But I think overall, yeah, there is tends to be a respect for the natural world, like I said, a phenomenological understanding that the world is the world and we are who we are, but we can learn from the world and we can share the world with others, and that's to our benefit and to our joy. Impacting it in a negative way is not going to help us.
So I think that Goody, your question is a great example of the kind of two worlds colliding in Manhattan, the island of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know the tribal perspective, but the current academic view that I've read is that, you know, when I was a kid, we were taught that, oh, you know, the white Europeans bought the island of Manhattan, right? And what they now say, or the academic perspective that I've read, is that, you know, what they bought was the rights to hunt and fish there. That's what the natives would have understood. It's like, mm-hmm. Okay, nobody can own land in our view, they're saying, but we will, you know, for a fee, respect your right to have exclusive hunting and trading and stuff there. And so what they were buying was actually a kind of time-limited right, as opposed to owning property, which was seemed to be a kind of foreign idea. And so you have the sort of collision of the Lockean view and the Native view right there at the beginning of American history.
I was trying to figure out how in the world did they, like we can barely grasp how odd it was that people were coming in to own land or say this is mine. Like, I think we can get there a little bit, like, oh, it's all public land, but did they even see it as public land so much as it's just its own thing? And
well, there's a great story. After the treaties were signed, there was an 1851 treaty, and then there was an 1868 treaty for the tribes in eastern Montana and in that neck of the woods. The 1855 Lame Bull Treaty kind of affected this group up here, the Blackfeet and the Teton. After the treaties were signed, the government, of course, was still seeking more land. And some would say even to this day they're still seeking more land. There was an incident where the government representatives came to the Crow tribe, the Upsaloga tribe, and told them that they were going to be taking land from the northern portion and western portion of the reservation. And they brought and they set up all these goods that they were going to exchange. All these things that the Crow people really didn't want or were even useful for them, like hardtack flour, sugar, rice, coffee, a lot of stuff that, you know, they really didn't have all that much use for. And so they put it all down in the camp, and then the general there started saying, well, this is your payment for the land that we're going to take, from you now. And so the community at the time saw that big, all those trade goods there, and said, oh, okay, yeah, we get it. Ran back to their lodges, you know, and within 2 hours, they had set up right next to all those items their 800 bison robes. And they said, oh, you guys want to trade? Well, we don't really know exactly what all this stuff is, but here's 800 bison robes in exchange for all this white stuff that you guys gave us. And the general said, no, you guys don't understand. This isn't about trading buffalo robes. You can keep your robes. We are taking the land, and we're giving you this stuff here. All this wonderful stuff, this gluten and rice, sugar, you know, the makings of civilization. And so finally, one of the head men there, one of the tribal representatives, name was Crazy Head, stepped up and said, oh, okay, I get it. So you're giving us all this, and you want to take that, you want to go over there to that land over there, and you want to do stuff on it. Well, what do you want to do? Do you want to hunt? Do you want to catch those underwater beings like you guys do? Do you want to dig in the ground for stuff? What do you want to do? Because if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. We're giving you permission. You don't have to give us this stuff for that land. We're letting you go ahead and do what you want to do. So that was the famous exchange. And the general was still like, no, you don't understand. We're taking that forever and ever. Amen. And it doesn't matter if you're giving us permission. We don't want your permission. You know, we want that land. And for the Crow people, again, it was one of those times where they were kind of like, what planet are these guys from? You know, and what exactly is their intention here? But they learned pretty quickly that the intention was, you know, just like when the treaties say, as long as the grass grows and the river flows, and that is going to be separate now from where you guys are able to inhabit, where you're able to roam. And right now, even as we speak, the Supreme Court's getting ready to hear a case about hunting rights off the reservation that was guaranteed in the treaty. And
Shane, is that so that happened? So the original area went all the way up into the Bear Creek, right?
Oh, we owned all of the what's today known as the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness and the Yellowstone Park, all the way up past Livingston to the Musselshell River, where the river bends at Roundup to head into the Missouri, all across down there, all the way down to about where present-day Miles City is.
So this meeting was a kind of changing boundaries and shrinking it down to the current?
It was a whole process. You know, the one treaty change, the chipping away process. That wasn't the once and for all. Mm-hmm.